So we have a small change in the program. We switched Professor Rumelin talk and Professor Cappelletto talk for technical reasons. Professor Julian Nida Rumelin teaches philosophy and political theory at the University of Munich, and he will give a talk on democracy and truth. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. So 30 minutes for a quite complex thematic, complex topic. After 5 years in politics, I returned first to a political science institute in Munich, the Schwester Scholl Institute, and then later on in the philosophy department. And I wrote a little book on democracy and truth. And this was, well, philosophically based on some old-fashioned metaphysical realism, even including a meta-ethical realism. That's obviously a dissent we have, but metaphysical realism, including meta-ethics, means that we have objective reasons to act morally in this sense or the other. There are objective reasons in both camps, in empirical and in the normative camp. But I presented these arguments not so much for philosophical reasons, but for political ones. I got the impression that the form of political discourses, of public reasoning, is threatened by attitudes that tell it's always the message and not the fact. It's always how we get some impact on certain positions, not so much to find out what's good for us or so. To find out what's good for us, the Dewean perspective on democracy. And, well, the form I presented these arguments were, again, more philosophically, and therefore the audience was limited. And it was kind of strange that many years later, not my initiative, the book was translated into three languages: Chinese, Greek, and Italian. Whatever the reasons for this selection is, yeah? Chinese, Greek, Italian. Last year it came out in Italy. Well, one could comment on that, why maybe these three languages in which it was translated. Now I develop my argument systematically, but I begin with a more historical observation. I think the beginning of the idea that politics has nothing to do with truth is the long war between religions or confessions in Europe. So there was no way to find a modus of political decisions that were compatible with different stances on religious questions. After the beginning of the 16th century, there was not one church, but more than one, at least two, and many others, if you look more closely. And they all had the idea, we define what is good and what is bad, and we have an impact on what just politics is about. The idea, eius regio, cuius regio, eius religio, was a good proposal, but it didn't work. So this was before the War of the Confessions began, in the midst of the 16th century. So, and I think one can understand the idea that politics in general, and then especially democratic politics, should be distanciated from questions of truth, especially normative truth, comes from that. So the idea is, if we just base politics on interests and some very minimal form of reconciled interests, this is contractualism or contractarianism, then the fights are over. Then we have a form of rationalization of politics that keeps the distance between religion, normative beliefs, cultural identities on the one hand, and politics on the other. So this is one form, this is only one form, very good description now, yeah? It's a very good description. It's one form of liberating politics from aspirations to truth, yeah? So something like that. There's another form, let's call the postmodernist form. This says, well, it's a more radical point of view. Not only we changed the format of doing politics from questions of normative and empirical truth to questions of how to reconcile certain interests, but even more, we give up the idea that there can be any common normative basis, because the normative attitudes, perspectives, and values stem from cultural identities that are somehow prior to political action. So radical constructivism is a form of presenting it philosophically. Now when John Rawls wrote his book, or published his book, 1971, shortly after, again, the same debate came up. How much is interest involved and how much is cultural identity involved? No. Sandel's critique of Rawls is again the same form of conflict. And the communitarianism that evolved says, well, it's cultural identity. That's prior to politics, somehow prior to politics. And therefore, it doesn't make sense to develop a universalist frame of reconciling interests in the ways of fairness under the veil of ignorance. Fairness that is guaranteed by the veil of ignorance decision. Now, I think democracy that understands itself as being independent from questions of truth misunderstands the way it works. So, and this is the practical point of view. I was astonished, to tell the truth, during these years, in 5 years in politics, last years as Minister for Culture and Media of the national government in Germany, that the moment there are no journalists anymore in the room, the form of how to discuss questions changes. As long as there are journalists in the room, you don't get any severe discussion. This is interesting also if you look to the different forms of how to practice political decisions. British parliamentary system is different from the German is different from the French one, the Italian one. For the German one, it's special that so-called Ausschüsse prepare the law, proposals, the law proposals. And there, in general, there's no public admitted. And as long as there is no public included, usually there you get in a situation like in a seminar in philosophy, get arguments for and against, even not so much, partitioned by political party memberships as one might think. So my argument is in this book that I don't represent here again, is that we would live in a system of illusion somehow if this metaphysical assumption about the strict difference between politics on the one hand and finding out what is true and false would be the adequate description of what's going on. So we somehow would present a theater of illusions, giving the impression we try to find out what's right and wrong, but in fact we all know it's not about that, it's something else. And I go one step further. This is, you might know that Habermas' version of deliberative democracy, quite well known in the world, is based on an epistemic definition of truth, of normative truth. And the idea is that if there is a rational discourse, then in the end, if it is not, if all the rules of the rational discourse are respected, then in the end we get to something, we get to consensus that itself, independent from its content, is normatively valid. So valid, maybe, not true, valid. Yeah. Geltungsanspruch in German. Yeah. Universeller Geltungsanspruch. My position is realist. And the interesting thing is, we had with Habermas had some interesting clash of opinions, although there is the same attitude, deliberative democracy, and this is exactly that point. I would say, as in that moment, if somebody that who is participating in the political discourse says, well, the reason why I think we should do this and this is because I, or my party, or my union, has an interest in, it's not a contribution to political discourse anymore. It's something else. Whereas Habermas says, well, this is typical for the political discourse, it's my interest, it's your interest, it's his interest. No, that's not true. If you look at the face value, how do political discourses work, you find out that this is not the form in which arguments are presented. The form is, for example, in order to get more growth in economy, we need to do this and that, and we all have a common interest in growth, and then the dispute is one party says we have to do this, and the other says we have to do this in order to reach that aim. But to say, no, then what I'm saying here is just a representation of my interests, or interests of my union, or my group, or my party, stops political discourse. In that moment, it's not anymore political discourse, it's something else. Like a bargaining game, to find out what the salaries should be in the future, for example. So the first thesis is, the way in which we give and take reasons, present arguments, present projects in the political sphere is bound to the presupposition that we try to find out what is objectively good for us. Objectively good for us. Depending on interests, depending on history, depending on cultural identities, whatever. It's not about finding out what my interest group wants or whatever. Now to put in a little bit more of philosophical underpinning. I think the problem with truth in democracy has to do with something that one might call certism. You say certism in English? No, probably not. Certismus. Certism. So what I mean is the following. Usually, if somebody says, well, I'm a realist. I think propositions or beliefs are true or false. And it's important to find out what belief is true. Then the second question is, you get, well, and how do we know what is true? And then the answer is, yeah, we ask scientists, or we have a certain method. No. I would say one should, from the start, combine realism with fallibilism. We can always be wrong. We can never be sure. There is no method. There is no expertise that tells us what is true. A whole scientific discipline can be wrong about it. But we should be epistemological optimists. So there should be some relation, or we assume that there's some relation between the practice of giving and taking reasons and finding out what is true or false, normatively or empirically true or false. There should be some combination. If we give this up, like Bacon did, Bacon said, look to Aristotle's poor philosophy and his eminent role in the history of philosophy. You can see, well, it's usually the worst arguments have the biggest success. Yeah, I exaggerate a little, yeah, but this is more or less that what Bacon says. Well, then we should give up the practice of giving and taking reasons. So there should be some optimism about that we have a chance to find out, and the chance is bigger if we have time to think about it, yeah, and to look to other arguments, and so on and so forth. So the combination of fallibilism and realism is important for the political sphere, because then the fear that many have, well, if it's about truth, then we have authorities that tell us what is true. No, this combination isn't there. You should be fallibilist regarding truth, but we find out, we try to find out by giving and taking reasons what is true. So the second philosophical aspect is skepticism. Let's take a Wittgensteinian view that basically says the following: it makes no sense to be skeptic about everything. You cannot be a global skeptic. You can only be a local skeptic. Yeah? Fallibilism means every proposition, every belief can be false. And if you are not a foundationalist, empiric, in the epistemological sense, then there are no givens. Yeah? There is not a class of propositions that are given and the starting point of everything. So I think it's more reasonable to be coherentist, maybe in a very careful way, not telling that sets of coherent propositions define truth, only in a much weaker sense that what we do in giving and taking reasons is to find a coherent interpretation of what's at stake. Try to find out what coheres better with that, what we find or think to be well-founded. So there is a difference of subjective probability, epistemic subjective probability about what is true, and this is the starting point of giving and taking reasons. So we try to find out where we have no difference in opinion, and this is the basis to solve the differences. So this is the usual way how the giving and taking reasons works. So anti-global skepticism. So the minimal realism that I think is necessary to understand adequately what's going on in the disputes, normative and empirical disputes alike, says whether some normative or empirical proposition is true or false is never defined epistemically, same as Chomsky said. So there's no epistemical definition of truth. We should be fallibilist in that sense. Even the best justified statement can always be wrong. And this can be combined with the Deweyian conception of democracy very easily. The Deweyian, John Dewey, conception of democracy is, democracy has an analogy in scientific practices insofar as, in both cases, we rely on the practice of giving arguments for a certain belief, finding out what others think about it, do this collectively and includingly, including all that are somehow interested in that discussion. And in the case of democracy, we have to include expertise in a way that everybody can understand what this expertise is about. So scientists, for example, participating in political discourses have to change terminology in order to be understood. And they should go outside and contribute what they know against populism, so to say, against an emotionalization of political discourse. So, truth without certainty, fallibilism, anti-global skepticism, minimal realism, in the sense of thing, or propositions can be true, even if you have no good arguments or methods to find out what is really true. Now, to be a little bit more concrete, last part of what I wanted to present here. You mentioned the web also in the description of this conference. And I think this is an interesting case in which one can explain a little bit more what realism, what the impact of realism is in the sphere of communication. So, usually, there are some mathematically interesting mathematical results. Schmeidler began with these studies many years ago, and in the meantime, it's the heading is judgment aggregation. Yeah? So, judgment aggregation, the problem is the following: do we have a certain judgment? I have an opinion, you have an opinion, the other person has an opinion, and we agree or disagree on certain points. Now, how does this evolve further? So the original postmodernist view is, well, now is power relation. Now comes power relation to play. Who has the power to force the others to accept his opinion or her opinion? Maybe the Germans among us know this that debate between Rainer Forst and me. He has a big project in Frankfurt, normative orders. And Rainer Forst, there is a conceptual frame of this project, and this is about the relation between power and reasons. And the definition Rainer Forst and his research group in Frankfurt gives is power is always about getting other people to adopt certain reasons, to act or to believe. I think this is wrong. Reasons play an important role in power relations, that's for sure. But the description is wrong and very dangerous. It somehow dissolves discourse ethics and Habermas school with postmodernism, even if Rainer Forst doesn't realize that. Look, if we have a conference, let's say in physics, and there is a guy who has good arguments for a certain theory, and he presents these arguments, and let's additionally assume the theory is right, it's a good theory, true theory, and he convinces the others that this is a good theory. Has this anything to do with power relations? I would say no. Obviously not. It's even, on the contrary, in many cases, to give good arguments for what is the case empowers others, maybe against me, to be wrong about facts is usually hindering your own effectivity in acting and interacting with others. So giving good reasons for true propositions is not a form of having power. If you adopt this position, then everything becomes power play, so to say. Now, I would say on the contrary, and this is part of also what I call humanistic or deontological semantics, to give reasons is not, as Greis in some articles presented it, a way of influencing others. No. to give reasons is something what might in some cases be motivated by your own interests, but in this deontological understanding of semantics, it's kind of different. You give reasons because you have certain opinions. You give these reasons because you think these arguments speak in favor of certain belief, certain decision, maybe even certain emotion. What the person does with it, it's up to this person. It's even, I think, specific for giving reasons that it's not instrumental for influencing persons. You might think of a situation in which there are effective means to get the person to do something. For example, threats. Yeah. You refrain from it by giving reasons. You could get the person to do something with the threat. You refrain from it and say, well, I think this and this is such and such. And then it's up to the person whether this person is affected by this reason or not. It's a form of respect in a way. So to give reasons and take reasons is a form of respect. And there Habermas and Dieter Rivelin are close in this, you see. Not in the metaphysical underpinnings, but in this aspect. And now it's depending on the frame in which communication takes place. If you have no chance to develop an argument because, for example, nobody listens, or because any person that has a different opinion from the majority doesn't have any chance to speak, then this practice of giving and taking a reason and find out what is good or bad or true or false is somehow, how do you say, deteriorated. It doesn't work anymore. The relation between arguing and finding out what is true is split somehow. It doesn't work. And now the web communications are ambivalent, I would say, in this respect. One can see that there is much more argumentation, deliberation going on than before, because, let's say, it's so easy to be a member of a group, for example, and discuss certain problems that you are interested in. So the number of participants in also political and social and cultural discourses have risen for this reason. This is one aspect. The other aspect is that we have particularization of discourse practices. You find groups that have similar opinions and then you discuss with this. The Facebook algorithm even makes sure that this is the case. Yeah. You get this information that you like by this algorithm. And this is contrary to one central element of democratic discourses, and this is the inclusion, the idea of including everybody. Yeah. So you have, on the one hand, you have a repoliticization, wide web communication, and on the other hand, you have a partmentalization of web communications, and this, in fact, weakens the democratic substance. And I think some successes of some populist movements have to do with that. So the question is not so much how do we get the gatekeepers again into play, but how do we have a complement to traditional gatekeepers that makes sure that the better argument has better chances to succeed than the worst argument. So, and this is going on, I think. The idea of an anarchic structure of web communication was always wrong because it can't work for mathematical reasons. It's no anarchical structure, but the form in which this communication is limited is framed. Yeah. The form in which it is framed depends on mostly commercial interests and other hidden interests and hidden agendas, which make it difficult to have a form of discourse in the web that is friendly towards democratic development, that is based on the aspirations to find out what is good for us. Okay, that's it.
Okay, so discussion, Professor Ferreis.
Thank you very much, Julian. I really appreciate your presentation. Just two points. I completely agree on the fact that it was a mistake in Habermas' view to link knowledge and interest. It was the proto-pseudo of Habermas that made prejudice to all his position. Problem is that this is also a commonsensical view. Mm-hmm. What strengthens this position is that it's also the position of common sense. Mm-hmm. John Searle spoke about the confusion between ontology and epistemology. Mm-hmm. There is also, which is very important, there is also confusion between the meaning of democracy. In the sense that democracy is something to do in order to make decisions, not in order to make to state about matter of facts. Well, the most of people are barely convinced that to be democratic is to democratically discuss on majority point, on majority argument about what is objective.
Maybe I give an example to make it more concrete. I don't know whether in Italy and France the same debate is going on for the moment, but in Germany it was a heated debate about the question, when are you allowed to marriage? And the reason is obvious, because there are coming some couples and the wife is 15 years old and the man 35 or even 45 or 60. And then we found out that in Germany it was possible to marry with 16 years, and in some cases even earlier. So we thought, okay, so we should change that. Now, a heated debate, and there's many strange coalitions, and so I don't go into the details. Now, which interest is here relevant? The interest of those young women is important. A tiny, tiny minority, not even normally not being citizens, in Germany. A tiny minority. So it's about finding out what is the adequate form. Then even from the left comes the counter argument and said, well, the 15 years old may be a love relation with kids, then becomes a single woman with kids without husband in a cultural atmosphere where this is not accepted. Is this a good idea? Yeah, this was the original proposal of the justice minister in Germany to annulate these kind of marriages, and so on and so forth. So what's going on? How do we interpret it? And I think the interest interpretation doesn't work. Certainly the interests of these young women play a relevant role, but not the interests of those participating in the discourse. Yeah. Not at all. Not at all. So we try to find out what is good for them and not what is good for me or my group or whatever, or my party. Yeah. And so I think it is an inadequate self-description to have this view. Interest play a very important role to find out what is just and unjust. Yeah? But not the telling, well, this is my interest and therefore I have this argument, doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, there is a question. No, indeed, it was before the gentleman. Back. Yes, you.
Hi.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for your speech. I disagree with you, and I would like to try to explain why. Especially with the point that democracy and truth have to be related, or that the political and the truth has to be related. I think the problem is that there are two different kinds of democracy. You said it already, that the one question could be, what is ontologically true and what are ways how to find out best what could be true for society, which would imply some Platonian view on society. A few philosopher might have to say, okay, there is some kind of ideal society and we just have to find out how this could be. Or you can say democracy, and especially modern democracy, is a way to say, okay, now there is no ideal society, but there is a way that we as free individuals, we as free humans, can create our society. And I think that the part of the creation is very important. And for this, I think that to understand political is exactly the opposite. It's to say, okay, we must make transparent that political claims are not claims about what is true, what is objective, but the objectivity of a political claim is to say, I have this interest, I have this proposition of how we should live together, and we should use our resources to create the society that is more and that is free and that brings this freedom to reality. And I have an example. If one discusses about post-truth and some post-facticism or some kind of this, one can also see in Germany that I would say in the last 10 years the political has been disappearing. It is less and less real political discourse. It is like there are no alternatives. Many decisions are not made on really reasoning, but one says, okay, we need growth, we need a strong economy, and to have a strong economy, we have this black zero, schwarze null, and all these kinds of political things are not really about how we want to live, how we want to create our society. It's more something like, let's stop to deliberate, let's stop to discuss what is really good and moral for us all, let's just do what the bureaucracy would say.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a misunderstanding. Look, maybe your idea of Platonism is that there's some just order, independent from any culture and any social situation, and then we have to strive at this order and we have to tell people what's wrong with the society you're living. This is not my position. Look, interests, cultural identities, belongings, practices that we have in society are quite relevant to find out what's good for us all. It's not independent from interests to define what's good for us. Yeah? But the question is not what is my interest or your interest or the interest of the group in order to give reasons for. It's always given my interests and your interests and their interests. What's just for us? What's good for us? Given these interests, given these belongings, given, you see? So, but the last resort is not, well, discussion finished, it's my interest or the interest of my group. It has always been based on some universal idea of what's just for us, including all these different perspectives and interests and belongings. Yeah.
Question. So I'm wondering about this last bit that you're saying. I mean, because here's an idea. You can always start from, this is my interest, and I'm going to give reasons as to why my interest, why you, all of you, should, or all of us, why it's good for us. This is my interest, and and this is the position that stems out, like what I proposedly do, based on my interest, and I'm going to explain why we should do it, and these are my arguments for it.
Does it work, really?
I don't know, it's just a proposition, and I mean, and to show something, and then, of course, and then I'm talking to this audience, another element, I'm talking to you because we have some things in common, which is the minimal reality that you mentioned. Because, and to go back to your physics example, about, you know, like whether it's the truth that, or the best argument that has a link with truth, don't forget that, I mean, Niels Bohr and his Copenhagen interpretation, for a long time, actually, nobody dared question the personality of Niels Bohr. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of STS or sociological aspects playing out, even in hardcore science. No more in, like, you know, in social reality where things are.
Sure. I totally agree with this, that there are power relations. The power relations are relevant in what's going on in scientific disciplines and so on. The selection of research projects is highly politicized and economicized and so on and so forth. No, but the concept, you mean, I think to give a good argument is not itself, and to convince somebody is not itself a form of having power on somebody else. This is the argument. That power relations play a role in the factual form of also scientific discourses is obvious. I know that quite well, that's obvious. But if we define to convince somebody as one form of an act, or how to call it, an acting power on this person, then we interpret this giving reasons for a good argument, or giving reasons for a good hypothesis or a good theory, we reinterpret it as a power game, so to say. And this misunderstands what's going on there. That's the idea of the deontological and humanistic semantics. I give reasons in order to empower the other person to decide. She can be affected, or he can be affected, or not. It's not a form of influencing the person. That's not my aim. I could influence possibly in other ways. Charming, whatever. And the other thing you said at the beginning, I think this is extremely important to understand that point. If you have interests, and therefore you say, well, we should do this and this, that's okay. Maybe not truthful then if you say, well, we all have an interest in that because you have an interest in that. But the form of giving reasons doesn't work if you say, I propose we should do this because I have an interest in it. It never works. And why it doesn't work is because collective agency depends on something of joint intentionality. Tomele, Gilbert and others, joint intentionality. And joint intentionality comes up only if there's something that we together think meaningful, good, whatever. And we have good arguments. And this is how political action works. So now you might say, well, it looks like we have common values and norms and group ethos and so on and so forth. In fact, it's not the case. In fact, we all play only our game. I try to push through my interests. Okay, then we all would live in a world of illusions. We would give reasons that are illusionary. But I think this is an inadequate description of what's going on.
Okay, we have time for the last question, Professor Bogosian.
I think that I couldn't agree more with your lack of skepticism about the ability to give reasons, for them to be good reasons, for people to hear good reasons, sometimes be moved by them. Reason is real and reason can move. But I thought sometimes you were in danger of running together a normative remark like that about recognizing the fact that reason is possible and can work with descriptive remarks about how if you tried to manipulate people in ways that are not rational, that would never work. In fact, I think what we know from the work in social psychology is that unfortunately manipulation by non-rational means works only too well.
Sure.
This was all very nice. I completely agree with the Platonism as an ideal. But as a descriptive remark, I think that won't work.
Okay, but it's not that I confused these two points, but I still think that we have...
Say it never works to say...
If you tell it like this, if you say, well, I have this interest and therefore I want us to do...
That's an optional one, but appealing to people's fears and other things that are not themselves rational elements, that's in plain emotion.
May I go into this for a moment, because this position is easily misunderstood as overwhelmingly rationalist, so that's always reason that guide and so on and so forth. In fact, I'm quite skeptical about it. I think reasons mostly work only if it's an immediate relation to something not disputed. that we all accept. Yeah, we all don't want to have certain threats, terrorism or whatever. So you don't have to go into the details, you don't have to develop a long argument. If I say, well, we have to strengthen security in this and this respect because we all don't want a new act of terrorism, everybody accepts. So there's not much argumentation involved. But it's still the form of the reason is we have all this conviction, we don't want it, and this is a means to get to this aim. And so the form is still not like this, I think, or my group, or my party. It's always an appeal to what we.
Yes, but that's the surface, you see.
That's
the
surface. And
that's the surface. The surface is maybe, because that's the acceptable discourse, and maybe even the surface will change. But the crucial thing is, when I say we have reason based on security fears, when I'm appealing to something whose probability is tiny, sure, in order to motivate a massive change, I'm
and this works
I'm
in
not
any cases.
Reason.
Sure.
I am
sure.
Fear.
But I ask you, should we see it like Bacon? Reasoning plays no role?
No. Not at all.
I think we should be optimistic that it can help. Not always, but it can help.
We should be vigilant.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Good.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.